Welcome to ForTruth.net. My name is Mike Lacona, and I have a guest, special guest with us today. His name is Dr. Craig Keener, a good friend of mine. Dr. Keener is the professor of New Testament at Palmer Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's author of more than a dozen books and dozens of academic journal articles. I, in particular, just loved your commentary on John, which is two volumes in, 1,500, 1,600 pages, or it's well over 1,000, I know that. This guy cited, how many times did you think you cited the classics and ancient non-Christian sources within that commentary on John? It was amazing.
It was, including Jewish sources, it would probably be about 20,000 extra-biblical ancient references.
Amazing. Now, so you did that, and I love your commentary on Matthew through Erdmann's as well, a big commentary. You just last year or a couple years ago, you finished a massive commentary on Acts that's, over 7,000 pages?
Yeah, in print, I'm sure they'll find a way to make it smaller.
I'm really looking forward to that. And so now you just published a new book through Erdmann's, which is a major and just a great publisher with a great reputation. This was like a 800 and some page volume on the historical Jesus of the Gospels. And what a great book. I've just skimmed through it. I'm looking forward to getting more into it. Tell us a little about that book. What made you want to write it, and what contribution do you think it makes?
It seems odd that some supposedly critical scholars want to depend on texts that are a century, two centuries, sometimes in at least one case, about 19 centuries after the time of Jesus, for reconstructing the life of Jesus, and they often neglect the best resources we have, which are the Gospels that are in the New Testament. It's kind of an anti-canonical bias. Mm. So this is an argument that the Jesus that we have in the Gospels is actually the Jesus who makes best historical sense, given all of our records from the time.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward. I mean, the stuff that you had in there that I've seen so far just looks great. So, well, let's jump right into the study about the historical Jesus, upon which your book's based. What you talked about the primary sources. What are the primary sources that historians today, modern historians, use for learning about the historical Jesus?
The kinds of sources that we have available from antiquity, some of them are minor sources. We have some comments about Jesus from someone named Mara Bar Serapion from somewhere around the year 70, about a generation after Jesus' ministry, but it's only a handful of words, and it's not entirely accurate. It's second or third hand material. We have Josephus, who has a few lines about Jesus, a few lines about John the Baptist, and a few lines about James, the brother of Jesus, but again, it's just a handful of lines. Tacitus, who's actually writing in the second century, the early second century, just lets us know that it was common knowledge by this point that Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. Then you have some much later materials. You have the apocryphal Gospels, which are basically kind of ancient novels, mainly late second, early third century, the heyday of novels. You have the Gnostic Gospels, and I think we'll be talking more about those later. But the only substantive sources we have from the first century are the Gospels that have survived, that are now canonical. Mark was written, pretty much everybody agrees, within one generation of the ministry of Jesus. And there's a shared source behind Matthew and Luke within one generation. Most scholars agree on that. That is, by any standards used for ancient historiography, those are very early sources, and we can use those for reconstructing the life of Jesus.
So, okay, now if many scholars are so skeptical about the Gospels, why do they think they have any valuable information about Jesus? So, in other words, if a scholar doesn't believe the Gospels are inspired by God, why use them?
Well, scholars don't believe that other ancient biographies were inspired, but they still use them to get historical information about those characters. A biography within a generation or two is a highly valuable historical source. historians reconstructing ancient history often have to work with far less than that. Of course, there are many Christian scholars, including myself, who do believe that the Gospels are inspired. But even for other scholars, the Gospels are our best source. Scholars who prefer later sources have they often speak of those of us who prefer the Gospels that are in the Bible as having a canonical bias. But you look at the historical evidence, they're the ones with the canonical bias. It's just an anti-canonical bias.
Wait a minute. So you're saying that non-Christian or non-conservative scholars can be biased?
Well, the Gospels we have are the closest material we have to the eyewitnesses. So if somebody refuses to use those and appeals instead to sources that are much later, isn't that a reflection of bias? Oh, you wouldn't
absolutely.
Do that with other kinds of historiography.
Yeah, if we did the kind of moves that many of the highly critical scholars use, we'd be laughed at if we made those kind of moves as evangelicals. You know what amazes me too, Craig? When I was doing my research on philosophy of history and historical method, I was studying almost exclusively, or I should say largely, the strong majority of what I was studying were philosophers of history and professional historians outside of the community of biblical scholars. And it's virtually a unanimous consensus among them that every historian is biased, and even in non-religious matters, because of factors such as our race, gender, ethics, nationality, our political, philosophical, religious convictions, the way we were raised, the academic institutions we attend, our preferences, mm-hmm. The very group of people who we want their acceptance and respect. These things all taint the way we view the world and the way we view different things. And if this is the way it is, so that even in non-religious matters, historians are biased, it just seems so naive to me mm-hmm. when I hear a skeptic say that, well, because you're a Christian, you're biased, implying that they're not because they're not a Christian. And it just shows that they really are completely naive when it comes to historical investigation.
It's true. When I was an atheist, I certainly was biased.
Wow. Well, so let me ask you this. We talk about the Gospels. When we talk about them, let's talk about a genre or literary type of the Gospels. I mean, there are things such as myth and antiquity. There's poetry. There's, you know, what were the Gospels? What genre did they belong to?
Most of the way through history, most people read the Gospels as some form of biography. And that's the majority view among scholars today. In much of the 20th century, scholars didn't treat them as biography because they were different from modern biography. But modern biography is not the same thing as ancient biography. There were a number of differences. I mean, ancient biography did not have to be in chronological order. It could start with the person's public career rather than earlier. But the Gospels fit what we know of biography. They're the right length for ancient biographies. They fit the topic for ancient biography, which was just a book about one person, a major part of the person's life or public career. And the other options of among ancient genres are just unworkable. The Gospels aren't novels, because novels didn't have all sorts of sources like the way we see Matthew and Luke using sources. They certainly weren't epic, which was poetry. They weren't tragedy or comedy, which also they were also poetry. In terms of what genre biography was most closely related to, biography was closely related to history, as classicists often point out. George Kennedy, in fact, an expert in rhetorical criticism for antiquity, views biography as a type of history.
Mm. Now, you'd mentioned just a few moments ago that biographies largely focused on a person's adult life.
They could also deal with their childhood or their infancy. So in the same way, we have some
is
Gospels.
Is it typical to do that?
It could go either way.
Okay.
The focus, though, would be on their adult life.
So
normally,
a lot of times I'll get questions. People will ask, a student will ask, well, why don't the Gospels mention more about Jesus' childhood? So it sounds like what you're saying here is, well, that's just the nature of the genre of biographies. Many times they just focused on the adult life. They hardly mention the person's childhood. Is that a correct answer?
Yeah, that's true. They focused on what was of greatest interest to the point about which they were writing.
When we talk about biographies in antiquity, other than the Gospels, then name some other biographies that were written. Of course, we know of Plutarch. He wrote about 50 of them at the beginning of the second century. We still have what, about 40 some of them. Who name some other biographers of antiquity of the time?
Suetonius wrote about the same time. He wrote the Lives of the 12 Caesars. Tacitus wrote the Agricola, which was a biography of his father-in-law. You can say, well, Tacitus was biased because he likes his father-in-law, but maybe he liked his father-in-law for good reason. You also have Cornelius Nepos. I was in one meeting where somebody said, Gospels can't be biographies. Biographies didn't exist until later. And my response to him was, what about Cornelius Nepos? He was writing in the first century BC. He said, I hadn't heard of Cornelius Nepos.
Okay. All right. Well, now when we talk about the canonical Gospels being biographies and that they were interested in history, were they more trustworthy sources than, say, the Gospel of Thomas or these other so-called Gospels like the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Peter?
Yes. Luke 1:1 tells us that at the time Luke was writing, many others had undertaken to write an account of these matters. So a lot of people had probably written by the time Luke was writing. And I think every New Testament scholar alive would love to get their hands on some of these other sources. We have Mark, who probably wrote before Luke, and you know, we have Matthew and Luke, but most of these Gospels that Luke mentions are now lost. Certainly these other Gospels that you mentioned were not around when Luke wrote. These are much later works. The Gospel of Thomas is the earliest of these other Gospels. Most scholars dated around the year 140, so perhaps over 70 years, a couple generations after the time that Mark wrote. Nicholas Perrin, who has done a lot of work with the Syriac, argues that the Gospel of Thomas actually depends on the Diatessaron, which is a Syriac harmony of the Gospels, hence can't be dated any earlier than 170 AD, which is over a century after Mark. Gnostic elements also appear in Mark. In the Gospel of Thomas. We don't have any attestation of these kinds of Gnostic elements in our first century sources. These kind of elements only appear by the second century. We don't have Palestinian Jewish background in the Gospel of Thomas the way that we do in the canonical Gospels. There are probably some early reminiscences from oral tradition in the Gospel of Thomas, but we don't know what's early and what's late. And so since we can't be sure about it, it's really problematic. And then you have some strange kind of theology that's kind of different from what we have in our earliest sources. For instance, Peter asks about Mary and says, well, you know, she's a woman. Can she be saved? To which Jesus replies, oh, yes, if she continues in the faith, women too will become men. That's strange. But besides things like the Gospel of Thomas, you have the apocryphal Gospels, which, as I mentioned earlier, were novels. They were in the heyday of novels. They diverge from our earliest sources. They don't fit the background, the Palestinian Jewish background. And again, you have some strange things in there, like Jesus strikes some other children dead when he's a boy, and so on. The character's quite different from in the canonical Gospels. Comparing the Gospels that we have in the New Testament with the Gnostic Gospels is like comparing apples and oranges. These were not biographies. The genre is completely different from biographies. These were sayings collections. And in terms of what the sayings were like, Thomas is the most likely to preserve any accurate material. The rest of the Gnostic Gospels have more Gnostic elements. The Gnostics said...
No, they're not all necessarily sayings Gospels. They're like, Gospel of Judas isn't a sayings Gospel, is it? It's been a while since I've read it, but...
Yeah, Gospel of Judas is agreed to be late material, though, also.
Yeah.
And actually, some of the interpretations of the Gospel of Judas that were propagated in the media may actually be based on mistranslations.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
There's a big debate about that.
What about, say, the Gospel of Peter? That would be another one that some regard as somewhat earlier, one of the earlier non-canonical Gospels. That's not Satan's Gospel, right?
Well, the reason that it's dated early is because people think it's the Gospel of Peter mentioned in one of the Church Fathers.
Mm.
But if they're wrong about that, it could be as late as, say, the 9th century or
wow.
something. We don't know if that's actually the Gospel of Peter. And a lot of the elements in there are clearly not early. For instance, I mean, you have Jewish leaders waiting in a graveyard.
Mm.
Come on. they don't even understand the basics of ancient Judaism, besides having the anti-Semitic elements and so on. But the Gnostics, when they talked about their Gnostic Gospels and secret sayings and so on, I mean, they're admitting, because they say these were secret sayings passed on secretly, they're admitting that there's no public record, in contrast to the canonical Gospels, which were a matter of public record from the beginning. And you look at the history of the reception of these works. By the time of Tatian in Syria, by the late 2nd century, Irenaeus in France at the same time, they said that the church as a whole recognized that there were four and exactly four Gospels everywhere in the Roman Empire. The Gnostic alternatives circulated among fringe groups. They were never dominant. And if I can give you just one more of the Gospels on which some of these scholars have drawn as a reliable portrait of Jesus, or a reliable source for Jesus that they try to make earlier than the other Gospels, the secret Gospel of Mark, it portrays Jesus as basically a gay magician, in Morton Smith's view. There was a novel that came out where someone named Lord Morton discovered a hidden manuscript at a monastery. Well, it just so happened that a year after that, Morton Smith, at the same monastery, supposedly discovered a manuscript. No one but Smith has ever seen this manuscript. It disappeared soon after he supposedly saw it. So we have a photocopy of what claims to be an early manuscript, but there's no way to test even the page in which it was written. And critical scholars who rejected eyewitness claims in the New Testament, they accepted the eyewitness claim of Morton Smith. The problem is that forensic experts have now determined that this is a forgery, probably written by Morton Smith himself.
Wow. Interesting. Let me go back just for a moment. One follow-up question about the Gospel of Peter. You have the Achmin fragment, the manuscript from the 8th to 9th century that you mentioned. And I've heard this before. We're not even certain that this is the Gospel of Peter. So what makes, since we really don't know anything about the Gospel of Peter outside of Eusebius' statement about the Bishop Serapion, and that really doesn't say much about the Gospel of Peter to my recollection, why do they identify the Achmin manuscript with the Gospel of Peter? I mean, Peter's not even a prominent figure in it.
It's some speculation, but even if it were something that were identified as the Gospel of Peter later on, to think that it actually goes back to Peter, when it contradicts our earlier sources, it doesn't fit what we know about early Judaism, it doesn't fit anything that Peter himself could have said,
mm-hmm.
Why someone would use that to reconstruct the background of the historical Jesus as against the canonical Gospels, it seems to me that's just anti-canonical bias.
Okay. Now, scholars talk, and you mentioned about this a few moments ago, about Luke's prologue, how he begins his gospel. So what is Luke's prologue? Why is it important?
Luke 1:1-4 is a historical preface. It's not found in novels. I read one scholar who said, well, yes, you've got a preface in Longus's Daphnis and Chloe. Well, yes, there is a preface there. It tells you how Longus made the story up. That's not a historical preface.
Mm.
But
the same thing in like 2 Maccabees. It's not really a preface, I guess you could say, but he's saying that, you know, he's doctoring this thing up a little bit.
Well, actually, in 2 Maccabees, I think he's saying it's a condensation of the 5-volume work of Jason of Cyrene, if I'm remembering correctly. But yeah, maybe he had made some adjustments. But this is a historical preface. Luke specifically mentions historical subject, the things fulfilled among us. He mentions his purpose is to confirm what Theophilus already should know. So it's setting out that Luke Acts is a historical work. In verse 1 of this preface, he mentions that written sources were in circulation. Verse 2, he mentions oral sources and mentions that they come from eyewitnesses. Verse 3 of that preface, he mentions his thorough knowledge, which I would argue also involves his investigation, his checking some of the material out. And then in verse 4, he appeals to the knowledge. His readers already knew some of this. He's confirming, so it doesn't leave him a whole lot of room to be making things up. At face value, we would apply elsewhere, if this weren't in the New Testament, if this were just some other historical work, we would say, this is a useful historical source. It's within a generation or so. He's depending on materials, certainly within a generation or so. Normally, we would consider that to be substantially reliable information.
So everybody would look at that and, like you say, this looks pretty good if it weren't in the New Testament or if it weren't a religious source.
Right.
So the reason then that Acts is called into question isn't necessarily because it's written poorly or because there are things that would suggest in the text that it's false. Or novelistic or of some other sort of genre except historiography, other than the fact that it contains supernatural elements in it.
Precisely. It's a double standard against a Christian work.
Gotcha. So there we have the anti-supernatural bias coming in.
Yes.
Not because of anything intrinsic in the text itself that would suggest that it's non-historical.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, it's valuable to hear you say that, Craig, because as now one who has studied Luke Acts extensively and written a 7,000-plus page commentary on Acts, I mean, you know your stuff with this. Because if this Acts commentary is like your others, Matthew and John, you're really focusing a lot on the historical stuff within here.
Precisely.
You deal with interpretations, but it's a whole lot of stuff about history. So your opinion is very valuable here.
It's about three times the word count of the John commentary.
That's just amazing. All right, so let me ask you this then. What figures would have had the most credibility to pass on Jesus's life and teachings?
Samuel Burskog has done a lot of work showing that historians consulted eyewitnesses. And you read the ancient historians where they weren't present, they would especially like to go consult eyewitnesses or consult, you know, the closest thing they could get to the eyewitnesses. Those nearest Jesus, it turns out from Galatians chapter 1, which is it's undisputed. It's somewhere around the mid first century. It's undisputed as a Pauline work. Those nearest Jesus were also the top leaders. In Galatians chapter 1. They were the ones who were leading the church. So maybe a decade or so before Mark wrote, these people were still alive and in leadership in the church. They were the eyewitnesses. Somebody comes along and makes something up that contradicts what the eyewitnesses would have said. Who's going to believe them when they've got the leaders? You know, in the early churches were networked. It wasn't just like some people portray it like in some gospel scholarship, you know, here you have a community over here that doesn't communicate with the community over here, and they have their own ideas about Jesus. We know from Paul's letters, we have concrete information there, that the churches were networked. We know from other ancient sources that synagogues were networked in the ancient Mediterranean world. We know that travelers generally carried news from one place to another. So we have the leaders and their traditions, those were the ones that would hold the most credibility, and they would be widely known as well.
You know, what you're saying there, it's I don't think most people recognize how strong what you just said is. Because in Galatians 1, I mean, it says Paul, 3 years after his conversion, goes up to Jerusalem and meets with Peter. And the word meet, of course, historesi, from which we get the word history. I mean, he's asking Peter, interviewing Peter to tell him about Jesus. He's getting this directly from Peter. And then he says he also saw James, the half-brother of Jesus, while he's up there. And then in the next chapter, he meets with Peter, James, and John and runs the gospel he'd been preaching past them. So I'm thinking about this, and It's like you got Peter, James, John, and Paul in the same room. What would that have been like? Wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on that wall and listen to these four of the biggest figures in the early church talking about these things? And it says, like Gary Habermas points out, they didn't add anything to what Paul had to say. They basically gave him the right hand of fellowship and said, you're good, Paul. And what you're saying is good. So it's like we can be entirely confident that what we hear from Paul was completely compatible with what the apostles were preaching. What Peter, James, and John were preaching, we have what amounts to be certifiably official and formal proclamations or teachings of the disciples on Jesus. I mean, it's just so strong.
And Paul sometimes quotes sayings of Jesus, like in 1 Corinthians 7, or material about the eyewitnesses of the resurrection, 1 Corinthians 15, the end time sayings of Jesus in 1 Thessalonians 4 and 5, and so on. In the book, I actually have an appendix where I show the parallels, that there are just too many for coincidence, that when he says he's getting this from the word of the Lord, he's giving us in what may be the earliest document of the New Testament, earliest or second earliest document of the New Testament, he's giving us the same material that we have really only a few decades later at most in the written Gospels.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So would you say that's accurate then? We can be entirely confident that the Jesus tradition that Paul is quoting would have been something that would have been either directly from the Jerusalem apostles or would have certainly been in agreement with what they were teaching.
Oh, yes, for certain.
Okay. Would the disciples then, these Jerusalem disciples, or even their other leadership who were under their authority, like maybe Silas or Barnabas, how can we be certain that they would have remembered much about Jesus' teachings? I mean, you know, I'll be talking to my wife and she'll say something like, well, don't you remember I said this? And, well, no, I don't really remember you saying that at all. Or my kids do it all the time.
Yes.
How can we be certain that the disciples, even if they had passed it to Paul, how do we know that they would have remembered these things? How would they have known this information?
People don't remember everything. But we have to remember this is a school context. Jesus was teaching disciples. Everybody pretty much agrees that Jesus had disciples and that Jesus was a teacher. Ancient memory could be very well trained. You had storytellers, traveling bards who were not considered particularly educated, who could recite Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, for hours on end. And they could do it verbatim, or they could use what we sometimes call performance variation, change it up a little bit, and then change it back the next time. It's just a matter of changing the wording. But they had the story down exactly. You had orators who would give speeches for a couple hours, and they were expected to memorize these speeches. One of the five basic tasks of oratory was called...
they could have only had teleprompters.
Memoria.
Like today,
oh.
Huh?
Oh, boy. If we couldn't use notes when we were speaking... that would be more difficult for us, or PowerPoint, whatever. Elementary education. Memorization was a focus of elementary education throughout the ancient Mediterranean world. And when you come to disciples, which was a more advanced level of education in a person's teens normally, memorization was very important with that as well. There's one saying of one rabbi who was praising one of his disciples as a water tank that never loses a single drop of water, emphasizing, you know, how valuable it was for disciples to remember these things. A really extreme example would be the Pythagoreans, where it was said that they couldn't get out of bed the next morning until they recited back everything that their teacher had told them the day before. Now, that is an extreme example. I don't know for a fact that the Pythagoreans actually did that, but I like to use that with my students to tell them how they'll be quizzed the next day if they don't pay attention. But you didn't have to agree with your teacher, but you did have to preserve. You had to learn what your teacher said. You had to preserve it. You had to represent it accurately. And it was true even with deeds. Rabbis could use earlier rabbis' deeds as a precedent for saying, okay, well, we know this must be all right because Rabbi so-and-so did it. There's another story of a rabbi who was getting ready to make love to his wife, and he found a disciple under his bed. And he said, what are you doing under my bed? And the disciple said, well, we must learn everything from the example of our rabbis. I tell my students that if I ever find any of them under my bed, I will fail them for the course. but the point is that they would memorize the teachings of their teachers. They would learn from the deeds of their teachers. Sometimes also they would take notes. You don't have as much of that in Jewish circles, although Jewish circles probably tended to be more literate than others, and they could have done it. But you do have some of that. And in the broader Mediterranean world, even in terms of style, Arian's notes of Epictetus became the diatribes or the discourses of Epictetus. He preserves his basic style, for which Arian himself apologizes because it's not his own style. Quintilian's students went out and published a book in his name, after which Quintilian, who was a professor of rhetoric, wrote his own edition and said, you know, I wish they wouldn't have done me the favor of publication prematurely. They published their notes without consulting me. However, their information is very accurate. Again, I always tell my students, don't publish your lecture notes before consulting me. But the point is, disciples had to learn what their teachers taught. They had to remember it. It was a matter of honor to be able to propagate that, even if you didn't agree with it, to be able to propagate it accurately. If the disciples didn't remember what Jesus taught, that made them totally unlike what we would expect for other ancient disciples. Skeptics are the ones who are making a special exception for Jesus and his disciples here. They're the ones who are not reading this by normal historiographic standards.
Mm. Interesting. Now, as you're talking about how the disciples would have to remember because they weren't doing a whole lot of note-taking, of course, we didn't have laptops in which to type notes mm-hmm. while the prof mm-hmm. is speaking. We didn't have legal pads and pens. Mm-hmm. Didn't even have the ink kind of pen, the fountain pens mm-hmm. at that point. So, I mean, there's no way that you could take notes like we do today, it would seem.
No, not like today.
So if that's the case and the students are expected to remember these things and they don't have a photographic memory, I suppose their memories would have been better than ours today just out of the practice. Sheer exercising of them doing it. But I would think that certainly the professors, the teachers, the rabbis who are teaching mm-hmm. would have to teach in a certain way,
yes.
which would make it easy for them to remember.
Yes.
And so does that make more sense then of Jesus's parables?
Yes. And some scholars have also argued that Jesus' teachings, when retroverted into Aramaic, fit an easily memorizable form. Mm. They fit certain rhythms. Jeremias argued that. Some others have argued that. But even in terms of people with exceptional memories, I mean, you have Seneca the Elder, who had such an exceptional memory. He said that, you know, my memory isn't so good now. In my younger days, I could meet, I forget the exact number. Maybe I'm not a good example of this, but like 1,000 people in succession, and then repeat their names back verbatim backwards.
Wow.
I could hear a poem being read, and I could repeat it back. He says, but now that I'm old, my memory isn't so good. And then he proceeds to summarize all the practice speeches he heard in declamation school when he was younger. Now, Seneca is clearly an exception, but we have some other examples of exceptional memories back then. It wouldn't be surprising if out of all Jesus' disciples, you'd have some with exceptional memories. Plus, we're dealing with communal memory. It's not just the memory of one disciple. It's the memory of all the disciples who still form a team afterwards, who are going to be able to talk with one another. This is what Jesus said, and be able to recollect the things together. Good teachers back then often would reiterate a point in a variety of ways, so they're going to catch the themes, they're going to catch the basic ideas. Again, they didn't have shorthand yet in this period, but the disciples are going to have the basic structure of it. We even have a number of Aramaic figures of speech in Jesus' sayings that suggest to us that often, even though this wasn't mandatory, but often we even have the very voice of Jesus. I mean, it's not just the themes, not just the ideas, but often even the wording, albeit in translation.
You know, this is, as you're talking about these things, this is just really kind of convicting to me, because as a frequent speaker, you know, sometimes I think, well, how much of what I say are my audience member is going to take away with them and impact them or be able to remember. It sounds like, you know, the way that they taught in antiquity, they could take quite a bit away from them remembering it. And the way we teach today isn't necessarily that way in many ways.
What did you just say? Oh, no, just joking.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Just changing gears a little bit here. When we talk about certain quests for the historical Jesus, we talk about the kind of setting in which we're interpreting Jesus. So when we read Jesus's teachings in the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, do these teachings fit a Palestinian Jewish setting, meaning, or that would be more suggestive or compatible with saying that they heard him say these things in Palestine, Jerusalem, etc.? Or do they reflect more of a later Christian setting out in the, the city of Rome or something like that, that would reflect the kind of teachings that would be not really situated within a Palestinian setting?
Well, the later debates that were of interest to the church are missing here. You don't have anything about circumcision of Gentiles. The closest thing you have to the issue of kosher foods, which we know is a debate in the church, Mark applies one of Jesus' teachings that way. But even there, Mark doesn't create a saying of Jesus that says that. He takes a saying of Jesus and says, this is how we should apply this in Mark chapter 7. It doesn't change Jesus' words to fit the issue at hand. So it's not something that was made up by later Christians to fit their own time, even though they tried to apply what they had to their own time. The sayings and expressions fit a Palestinian Jewish setting. You have a lot of Aramaic figures of speech. Perhaps the most common, abundant example in Jesus' writings is where he says, Son of Man. You have that all over the place. Literally, it's the Son of the Man. Now, you think about it, that makes no sense in English. It didn't make sense in Greek either. That's a Semitic figure of speech. Jesus has sayings like, to what shall we compare so-and-so, in his case, the kingdom? The kingdom is like. That was a standard Jewish way of introducing parables or comparisons. We also have story parables. You know, you have other teachers used illustrations, but it was specifically Palestinian Jewish teachers who used story parables like Jesus uses. We could make an extensive list of these kinds of parallels, but the point is, these are things that go back to the earliest period. These fit the period before Jesus' execution. When Jesus was speaking in a rural Galilean context most of the time, the church leaders quickly settled in urban Jerusalem, and the common language of the church, the one language that everybody in the church could speak in an urban area like Jerusalem with the Hellenists and so on, shifted to Greek. That's very soon. And of course, Antioch, although in the countryside Aramaic was spoken, when the church spread to Antioch also, Greek would have been the dominant language of all the people gathered there. What that means is that these wouldn't have been things made up by the later church. These would be things that would go back to the very public ministry of Jesus himself.
Mm. Well, let me ask you this about the common language of the church quickly shifting to Greek. We're both in New Orleans right now, mm-hmm. attending the annual meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, 2009 in November. And I was at a seminar this morning, and Dan Wallace pointed out that two-thirds of the inscriptions on tombs in Jerusalem from that time period were written in Greek.
Yeah.
So it would seem to suggest, and the fact that the Titulus, the plaque put up on Jesus' cross about the accusation saying he was the king of the Jews, that was written in Hebrew and Latin and Greek. And you'd do that because there were people in Jerusalem. This was a trilingual language. I mean, I go to New York City, people are speaking Spanish, they're speaking English, they speak Spanglish, where they're just mixing things up. I mean, I can almost imagine this happening in Jerusalem, where you're talking and maybe going back and forth between Aramaic and Greek, or throwing a little Latin in there, perhaps. If Greek was around a lot, how does that impact what you just said about the common language of the church shifting to Greek from Aramaic? Could it have been that many of them were already quite fluent in Greek?
Many of them would have been. Galileans probably were mostly bilingual, although Aramaic would have been the mother tongue in most of Lower Galilee. But in the case of my wife, is she gets along in five languages. You know, here on the phone, speaking, she'll shift from French to Kitsangi to Munakatuba, depending on who gets on the other line of the phone. And of course, you know, in English as well, and she can handle some other languages somewhat too. For some of us in the United States, that's a difficult concept. But many people were bi or trilingual. Now, the thing is that the foreign Jews from elsewhere in the Mediterranean world who settled in Jerusalem, they would be exclusively Greek-speaking. We know from the burial inscriptions in Rome, for example, you had some Latin speakers, but the majority language was Greek, and there was probably very little knowledge of Semitic languages in Rome, certainly very little knowledge of Aramaic. Hmm. So you have these diaspora Jews settling in Jerusalem, and the common language in which the church can work would be Greek. And so the translation probably happened very early.
So let me ask you this, since we are talking about the historical Jesus here, what languages did he speak or read? In what languages could he converse, do you think?
Certainly in Aramaic and Greek. Some people would also say Hebrew because of his debates with the scribes. But in Jerusalem, the Sadducees, the wealthy priestly aristocrats, would have probably been speaking with him in Greek. But in the Galilean countryside, he was probably speaking in Aramaic.
So when he's before Pilate, they're probably speaking in Greek.
They'd have to be speaking Greek. It's not, I mean, with all due respect to the movie that...
Passion of the Christ.
which, you know, it was great, the Aramaic parts, but he would have spoken to Pilate in Greek, not in Latin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought that too when it came out. So how fluent do you think Jesus would have been in Greek?
Yeah, I think he would have been fluent in it.
Okay.
He could have conversed in it.
Well, now it's interesting. I'm curious to see what you have to say about this. I just wrote an article that's going to be published in January in the Journal of the Study for the Historical Jesus, the Study of the Historical Jesus, on Jesus' passion predictions, in which I present six historical arguments for their authenticity.
Excellent.
At least, you know, the idea behind it, that he predicted his violent death and resurrection. So I'm aware that there are numerous scholars who deny that Jesus foreknew his death, in contrast to what the Gospels claim. So if we were using purely historical, methodology, how would you approach this? What do you think we should think in terms of Jesus' predictions concerning his death and resurrection?
Using purely historical means, I would say that all the commentaries and all the works that say Jesus couldn't foreknow his death are being very unrealistic. Even without supernatural foreknowledge, Jesus had to foreknow his death. You can't go overturning the tables in the temple, thereby challenging the honor of the aristocratic priests, fail to flee or fight, and not expect your death. He provoked his death.
In other words, it's kind of like the same as if you go into downtown Mecca and start preaching the gospel, you must have a good idea that it's not going to take supernatural foreknowledge to know that you're probably going to die.
Precisely. Unless you have a helicopter waiting for you or something, you're going to be in trouble. And furthermore, there's no reason that we should presuppose that Jesus was not a prophet. Anti-supernaturalism is held by a small percentage of the world's population, and anti-supernaturalists are insufferably arrogant to insist that everyone who wants to be a true intellectual has to simply buy into their presuppositions. When I was an atheist, I bought into them, and I was arrogant, and I was wrong. Jesus intended to die, but again, even apart from the supernatural issue, he intended to die. He provoked his death, and the Last Supper shows us something about how he interpreted his coming death. It's multiply attested. It's not only in the Markan tradition. It's also in Paul, 1 Corinthians 11, which I neglected to mention earlier. And you have Aramaic figures of speech, Palestinian Jewish Passover customs, not only there but in the surrounding context as well. And according to what Jesus said there, he intended his death to inaugurate a new covenant and to atone for sin.
Mm. That's interesting. And you know, you just mentioned that the Pauline passage on that, multiple attestation in Paul in 1 Corinthians, this was like a real eye-opener for me. I mean, we can, sometimes it's hard to recognize whether something is a separate tradition. But in this case, it's really profound because, you know, by the estimations of most scholars, Mark is written first, prior to Matthew, prior to Luke. And so Mark, he has Jesus predicting his death when he's at the Last Supper. And then in Paul, who again is writing before Mark by maybe as much as a decade or even more, when he writes 1 Corinthians, he mentions that same sort of foreknowledge of, on Jesus' part, that he's going to die. And it's that very tradition that Paul quotes, which seems to be this Jesus tradition that had been passed along to him. It's that very tradition that Luke is citing almost verbatim. And it's more, Luke is citing that in line with Paul, not with Mark. Now they're pretty much saying the same thing, but it's very clear. It's crystal clear that there are two distinct traditions. And Luke is citing the one from Paul who's earlier than Mark, and Mark is citing a different one. So it is multiple attestation, and we can see it goes back to that early Jesus tradition, which Paul would have received and been able to check out with the Jerusalem apostles. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, this is just amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. It's so different than, it gets so much more sophisticated and interesting than when a skeptic will say, well, that's just in the Gospels, they're all legend. Well, yeah. Wait a minute, it's not that simple.
And sometimes the skeptics have to do gymnastics to come up with defenses around these kinds of points.
Mm.
Looks like gymnastics to me, anyway.
Absolutely. Now, some scholars have argued that the Romans arrested and executed Jesus without the involvement of Jerusalem's leaders. I remember when the Passion of the Christ came out, someone contacted me, and they said, hey, there's a professor of Judaism at one, and he's a Jewish guy, he's at one of the Ivy League schools, I'm not going to mention which one it is, but he had written an article for some newspaper out on the Northwest. I don't know if it's Seattle or Washington or what, but it was out there in the Northwest. And he was saying that Gibson's movie was anti-Semitic because all scholars know that the Jews had no part in Jesus' death. And I remember, you know, thinking, well, I mean, I would just normally give the answer to the person. But I thought, you know what, this is just amazing. This Jewish professor at an Ivy League school would say this, and nobody's going to check this guy. So I emailed him and I said, what about Josephus in Antiquities of the Jews, book 18, section 3, where he says, at the instigation of the leading men among us, Pilate crucified Jesus. And I said, most wouldn't think that this is an interpolation, even though the parts of that passage are questionable. And he said, you're right. And the Jewish leadership of that day was involved in it. I'm just trying to avoid anti-Semitism in this. And I said, well, yeah, but you can't change history with this. There's better ways of doing it. I mean, we don't want to say about the Holocaust, let's not mention that it was the German leadership behind this, because you might have some anti-German sentiments. It's really amazing, isn't it, how people like to rewrite history in our politically correct subculture. It's just dominating Western civilization.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is, as well as the anti-supernatural bias, affects the way people sometimes read the Gospels.
So how would you say, what would you say about that argument, other than the Josephus passage? Is there anything else you would say about whether that argument to say that the Romans did it without the Jewish leadership involved at all, how plausible is such an argument?
Rome normally worked through local aristocracies. That's just how they did things. They used delatores, or accusers. Anything that was a threat to the stability political stability of the region, anything that was a threat to Roman rule was a threat to the aristocracy's power base. So, of course, the local aristocracy would act this way. This is not talking about all Jewish people. This is talking about these particular leaders at that time. We have an analogy to what was done to Jesus. It wasn't just done to Jesus. Similar things were done to some other people. Joshua ben Hananiah, about a generation later, was going around prophesying against the temple. He was arrested by the priestly elite. He was handed over to the governor. And then he was scourged, Josephus says, in book 6, somewhere around paragraph 300 or thereabouts. He was scourged until his bones showed, Josephus says. But then he was released because everybody thought he was mad and he had no following. But Jesus of Nazareth was not insane, and he did have a following, and the narrative makes very good sense as it stands. This is just the way things were done back then with those who were considered potential troublemakers. Now, often the reason for the argument, as you've noted, is to avoid anti-Semitism. But it's not anti-Semitic to critique Jerusalem's elite. They oppressed the poor priests. They oppressed other Jews. The Pharisees criticized them. The Essenes and others criticized them for corruption, sometimes violence. Josephus mentions their corruption. He mentions one of the high priestly leaders who was bribed to commit murder. He mentions even division among the chief priests themselves. A generation later, they're throwing rocks at each other in the Sanhedrin.
It sounds a lot like our government today, doesn't it? That's very interesting. Well, okay. Some scholars have offered pagan parallels for the stories of Jesus' resurrection. You don't see so much of these within academia today as you see on the internet, I guess.
Yeah, they were more common earlier.
I remember, was it T.N.D. Mettinger's book, The Riddle of Resurrection, written in 2001, where he deals with Near Eastern gods, and he says that pretty much the consensus among scholars today is that there are no parallels of dying and rising gods that predate Jesus. Mettinger says that there are three that he can think of, and as many as five. It's an interesting book, but in the end he says that there's no way the Christians copied off of them.
Right.
But I'm curious what you'd have to say about this. How plausible do you think it is to say that the Christian story about Jesus' resurrection was simply cut from the same cloth as stories about dying and rising gods that were, you know, just part of the culture of that day?
Well, the story of Jesus' resurrection, even the language of resurrection, it's a Jewish doctrine. The language in which resurrection is framed from our earliest sources, it comes from a Jewish context where they would be least likely to be talking about dying and rising gods. Unless we want to make all beliefs in life after death and all cultures parallels, which they look like parallels only to people who say, you know, we shouldn't believe in life after death. But you've got all sorts of unrelated beliefs about life after death in a lot of different cultures. And the stories of dying and rising gods, a lot of them have nothing to do with the kind of resurrection that we're talking about. Many of them are later. There are some, I believe that there are some early ones about a deity coming back to life. But this is like an annual return to life in the spring with vegetation. It's not a bodily resurrection like we're talking about with Jesus. You don't have bodily resurrections to physical immortality in these sources. That's an exclusively Jewish doctrine based in Daniel 12:2 and in some other Old Testament passages. That's the most explicit. People talked about ghosts and appearances after death, but these weren't bodily resurrections. If all the disciples had met was something about some ghost coming back, there would have been no controversy. Mm-hmm. There would have been no persecution.
Mm-hmm.
But they were claiming something else, something that threatened the very heart of Sadducean teaching, especially because, you know, the Pharisees and many other Jews believed this and disagreed with the Sadducees on this. They were claiming that the promised bodily resurrection had already invaded history in the sense that the first person to be raised from the dead had already come back to life.
Mm. So in your book about the historical Jesus of the Gospels, do you deal with the resurrection in there?
Yes.
So
I think
you
it's chapter 22 or so.
Yeah. So, or what, around page 300 or something?
Somewhere 400 something, I don't know.
In fact, I was looking through it and it's like, okay, the main body, the text of this more than 800-page book is just under 400 pages, and the rest are these informational footnotes or endnotes, indices, helpful indices, and bibliography. It's like this book is so well supported and documented. It's amazing. Craig, what positive evidence do you see that there is for the resurrection of Jesus?
Well, the most important is the fact of the eyewitnesses, the people who knew him best and would recognize him, the strength of their testimony. We have up to 500 on one occasion, of whom Paul says most are alive to this day when Paul was writing.
Which means they were like, he was saying it, suggesting, go ahead and cross-examine
them.
You
can check them out if you want to. Also, it happened on multiple occasions. These aren't things that could be hallucinations, because you've got it happening to a lot of different people, sometimes a lot of different people at once, and on multiple occasions. The strength of it is just beyond, you know, reports of apparitions elsewhere, which are on a much smaller scale. The witnesses are reliable. We know that they believed what they were saying. They believed that they saw him because they were prepared to die for the testimony. No one changed their story despite the cost. And if anyone had changed, enemies surely would have seized on this, requiring a counter-argument, but we have nothing like that in the New Testament. We have all sorts of other debates in early Christianity. In first century Christianity, we have debates about circumcision and food customs, like we mentioned. But despite the extraordinary nature of the resurrection, despite the potentially controversial nature of the resurrection, there's no dissent on this in any of our early Christian sources. Certainly the Gospels wouldn't have invented the testimony of the women, which was not considered to be honorable back then. In Roman law, in Jewish law, what Josephus says, just the witness of women was not as respected as that of men. Obviously, God didn't agree because women were witnesses of the resurrection of the Gospels, but it's not something the church would have made up. It's not how you do apologetics in that culture. Mm. And you look at the characteristics of the resurrection body, could walk through walls. it's not a revived corpse, and yet it's material. Jesus ate with them, he touched with them, he discussed at length. You don't have a mere temporary apparition. Besides the witnesses, you have an empty tomb. Most recognize that it clearly was empty. It's empty in Mark. It's presumed so in Paul. He doesn't have to state it because he's using the language of resurrection, which in Jewish sources, if you say resurrection, that's not something that leaves a corpse behind. Mm-hmm. Is it just a coincidence that besides the witnesses, you have an empty tomb? I mean, again, it can't just be an apparition. And again, no mere ghost. People had stories about ghosts. If they had only thought it was an apparition, they could have gotten away with that without persecution.
Mm-hmm.
But they staked their lives on the fact, and you would assume somebody's going to stake their life on it, and a bunch of people are going to stake their life on it with no detractors among the eyewitnesses. You can pretty well assume these people satisfied their curiosity. These mm-hmm. people were sure that they'd seen Jesus alive from the dead.
Interesting. Now, when we talk about the resurrection of Jesus, of course, although there's some evidence that can be cited in its favor, some very compelling evidence, there would be those today who would say, yeah, but come on, we live in the 21st century. Or as Rudolf Bultmann said, you know, how could someone now who, in light of electric lights and toasters, how can mm-hmm. we believe in the miraculous?
Mm-hmm.
So how could we say, you know, what would you say to the person that says modern science and all that we know about reality suggests that people don't come back to life from the dead? So whether it's a resurrection or other of Jesus' miracles, you know, do historians within their professional capacity as historians Do they have the right, the professional right, to take Jesus's miracles seriously, or should they just say that that is part of the realm of faith?
I recently read a dissertation on this by a splendid scholar that actually you ought to interview on this. His name is Michael Lacona. So interview yourself sometime. anyway, but since you're interviewing me at the moment, I'll do my best.
Absolutely.
I am writing a book on miracles,
but you're far beyond me on this.
No,
so.
Not on. Anyway, but I think our books will complement each other well. But most historians do recognize Jesus as a miracle worker, even without faith. I mean, they compare him with other historical figures whose ministries are impossible to explain without saying, okay, this was a miracle worker, whatever's behind these miracles.
And what you're saying by that, too, just to be clear to our listeners, you're not saying that the majority of scholars believe that Jesus performed authentic miracles.
By God, right.
By God. You're saying that the majority of scholars would say that Jesus performed deeds that both he, his followers, and many others regarded as miracles.
Right. People got healed.
Jaw-dropping deeds.
People got healed, but the scholars don't try to explain how they get healed.
Gotcha.
but they give examples, parallels with Simon Kimbangu in the 20th century and others who are close enough to our own time that there's evidence for that. But however one explains the miracles, there's no doubt that some people in history have attracted followings because of extraordinary events. There's a new branch of anthropology and spirituality in recent years that addresses such occurrences, not from a Christian standpoint. There's quite a lot of material. I've been just reading a lot of these reports.
Well, you've also, your wife is from the Congo.
Yes.
And you've relayed to me on several occasions how you've been over there, and just with your mind, your inquisitive mind and academic critical mind, you hear reports of miracles, even of raising the dead, and you inquire into those. So you're aware of some really weird stuff that's going on overseas and some of these other countries.
Yeah, those things happen. And these are eyewitness reports. These are reports from people that I've interviewed, I believe are credible, some of whom are my in-laws, who've seen these things happen. And the book on miracles, maybe we'll do another interview if you want. But
let me just ask you one other question here. I know we're getting just a little off topic, but I do want to ask this. What would you say to the person who brought up a human objection, who said, you know, miracles abound only amongst the ignorant? And maybe they're this culturally arrogant person that says, yeah, but you saw them over in the Congo. I mean, who are these Congolese people, you know, compared to us over here in North American Western culture? Yeah, of course they see miracles over there, but we don't see these kinds of things going on over here.
Hume said that only ignorant and barbarous peoples report miracles, which wasn't true in his own time. Blaise Pascal probably wouldn't have appreciated being called ignorant. But Hume was essentially, well, more than essentially, Hume was a racist. His anti-Semitism is known. There have been a couple recent articles that have shown that Hume looked down on peoples of color. Francis Williams, I believe, was his name. Hume said, "Well, you know, we know of one black person from Jamaica who supposedly recites poetry, but you know, parrots can recite things too." So he's just, you know, Francis Williams, the person of whom he was speaking, composed his own poetry in Latin. He was a Cambridge graduate. Hume was just a racist. And Hume's racism was actually quoted approvingly by Kant and others in their own defenses of things like that were very common in that era. And a lot of the slaveholders were quoting Hume while the abolitionists were working against him. So those kind of things have gotten into the philosophic discourse without people realizing where they come from. But it's unacceptable in today's multicultural world for somebody to say, well, you know, the testimonies in the West are the only valid testimonies, not the testimonies from, and plus I have testimonies from the West as well. I mean, it's not exclusively there, but I think we have the most reports on the cutting edge of evangelism, just like where we see them most commonly in Scripture as well. Hmm. Now, in terms of how they're explained, some people explain them as a placebo effect through faith, and I don't doubt that God can work through that, or, you know, by other means, you know, placebos do work. But we have analogies today that can't be placebos. I mean, again, I've interviewed people who've been raised from the dead or people who are eyewitnesses of those things. One of my colleagues,
You've raised Pete.
But
you've interviewed people?
I've interviewed people, yes.
Who have been raised from the dead?
Yes.
You have personally interviewed a person who was dead and that was now alive.
Yes, but they weren't dead when I interviewed them. I assure you of that.
Okay.
Now, and somebody can say, well, they're not telling the truth. But again, you know, as far as they had any means of knowing, the people who were telling me, I mean, my sister-in-law, when she was 2 years old, had stopped breathing for 3 hours. And when the person prayed over her, she started breathing again, and the next day she was fine. Mm. And she just recently finished her graduate work in Cameroon and returned to Congo. One of my colleagues in Hebrew Bible, Emmanuel Atopson, he told me about his father. Emmanuel has a PhD from Hebrew Union College. Emmanuel's father, he's from Nigeria, was planting churches in northern Nigeria in completely unevangelized areas. And there was this one village where he was, and he was trying to put a roof on his house, and everybody was laughing because they said, it's the rainy season. Everything you have is going to be ruined and drenched because the rains are coming now. And he said, it's not going to rain in this village until I get the roof on this house. It was either 3 or 4 days. He said, it's not going to rain. And they laughed at him. And he fell on his face before God. He said, God, please, don't let a fool be made of me. For the next 3 or 4 days, until the roof was on his house, it rained completely all around the village. Not a drop fell in the village. And by the end of that week, there was only one person in that village left who was not a Christian, because they knew what rainy season meant in that area. There are non-Christian examples of some superhuman power too, but we also have power encounters, what missiologists call power encounters, exorcism and the like, just like Moses' rod versus Pharaoh's magicians, that show what power in the world is greater than the other claims of power. I have hundreds of these kinds of examples in my next book. It's not due out just yet. I'm not quite done writing it, but on miracles.
That sounds fascinating. When do you expect that out?
Well, I got to finish it. But right now, you're interviewing me in November of 2009.
Will you be done in it in a year?
I would hope it's out in a year or not much later than that.
Oh, you would hope it'd be on shelves within a year?
Well, that's what I'm hoping.
Oh, that's great.
I'm almost done writing it.
You have a publisher yet?
Yes. Yeah.
Fantastic.
But my question is, why not allow God as an explanation for this? I mean, scholars don't have to. They can stay agnostic about the cause of these kinds of phenomena. But God sure makes sense as an explanation. Mm-hmm. It's merely a presupposition that God doesn't do miracles. Hume's arguments about that are completely circular. And as I learned from you, and I went back and followed up on the source that you provided for me, the majority of those writing in philosophy of religion today are arguing not against theism, but in favor of it. So there's no reason why that can't come back into academic discourse.
Yeah, and you know what? Also, you know, when you're talking about scientists, I mean, in parallel or other disciplines, you know, you have astrophysicists. They look at things, phenomena going on in our universe, and they posit theoretical entities such as black holes, quark strings, gluons. Mm-hmm. These are theoretical entities. They've never been seen. They probably never will be seen or observed. But they do a really good job of explaining what's going on behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. And if physicists can posit theoretical entities to explain certain phenomena, then why can't historians? It seems that we would be completely within our professional rights of saying, okay, look, like you said a moment ago, we can adjudicate on the historicity of an event and say, yep, this occurred. Now, what caused it? Well, let me posit a theoretical entity, God, and it works pretty well at explaining all the phenomena we see. And it's not really ad hoc, because the concept of God has been around for thousands of years, as long as we can go back in human history, we know about God. So, it amazes me how some just simply want to exclude the possibility of God in miracles. I really don't see any good reasons to do that.
Yeah, and it would be really hard for me because I know him. I have a personal relationship with him. But of course, people would say that's subjective. But then again, so is my personal relationship with my mom or my wife or somebody else. But I don't appeal to that as evidence on their level. But for myself, I know him, and this is characteristic of God.
So then, if we're talking about, you know, historical investigation, proving things with reasonable and adequate certainty, what is the relationship then? When you talk about knowing God now, you mm-hmm. mentioned a moment ago, so you brought the personal aspect, the kind of a subjective element in here. What's the relationship between history and faith, between evidence and faith, between knowledge and faith? How do you do that? Should we believe only what we can prove, as some of the skeptics would say? But then you would have some Christians say that you shouldn't look for evidence because that annihilates faith. Mm.
That's a definition of faith based on the Kant's dichotomy between subjective faith and objective reason, which is why Kierkegaard talked about a leap into the dark. But I don't think we're leaping into the dark. I think that we have enough knowledge to take a step into the light.
Mm-hmm.
But no historian will assert that only what we can prove to a high degree of probability happened. That would leave barely any history as having happened. We don't say it didn't happen just because we don't have all the evidence. Most evidence for most things no longer remains. What we can talk about is the burden of proof. We don't have a past shrouded in myth. When the sources are regarding these issues, when sources are reliable where we can test them, we should assume that they are reliable where we can't test them, because the writers of the Gospels didn't know where we'd be able to test them and where we wouldn't mm-hmm. 2,000 years later.
Now, can we test the Gospels anywhere and find that they're unreliable? Like in Tacitus, you know, we can find Tacitus is reliable in some parts and he's unreliable in others. So it'd be hard to say, okay, because we find him reliable in some, what about those parts that we can't test him? So, someone could come back and say, yeah, but we can find that Tacitus is unreliable in some parts. What about the Gospels then? If we could only show that they're reliable in the parts we can test, and then others were questioned, then we'd say, yeah, we should give them the nod, we should give them the benefit of the doubt. Are there any parts in the Gospels that you think, historically speaking, are unreliable?
If Tacitus is 80% reliable where we can test him, we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt where we can't test him. With the Gospels, part of the problem is because we try to read them in terms of modern historiography mm-hmm. instead of in terms of their own historiographic milieu. So, for example, things are not always in same chronological sequence from one Gospel to the next, but they weren't expected to be in ancient sources. Sometimes the wording appears a little bit different from one Gospel to the next. Sometimes you have one Gospel that a paragraph later it can repeat the same saying in slightly different words because that wasn't considered significant. Mm-hmm. People practiced paraphrase. So where we can test them and we have concrete means to test them, we find them to be reliable, and therefore the burden of proof would be on somebody who would be doubting them.
Okay.
In terms of what we talked about, the academic method, we look for minimally agreed assumptions for dialogue, what we can agree on. Now, the very minimum, I mean, there's nothing everybody agrees on almost, but in academic dialogues, in works, I try to start from, okay, here's what pretty much scholars will agree on methodologically. What can we find from this? Is there enough that we can find on this basis to point us in the right direction? And I think that there's plenty that we can find there. And that's how I do my scholarly work within the academy. At the same time, minimalism is not what's most probable, because to say what we can all agree on, well, nobody believes that's all that ever happened, is what we can agree on. Mm. And faith, we know enough about Jesus to invite faith in him. And once we put trust in him, we can trust the scriptures that he accepted as God's word, and we can trust the message of the eyewitnesses that he commissioned. Real faith has to go one step beyond saying, okay, here's some evidence, and I realize that there's some evidence here. Real faith has to recognize that this evidence demands something of us. It demands a decision. Faith is not just a fire escape. We have enough that we can say about Jesus to go beyond that and stake our lives on the truth of his claims. To submit to Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ, meaning the King, he's our rightful Lord and Master. Mm. And that's what faith, that's what we need to do in faith.
Mm. Let me ask you just one final question. What did you learn through, or what kind of conclusions did you come or learn in writing this book on the historical Jesus of the Gospels? Was there anything that surprised you?
Something that surprised me was how much evidence we really have, and how much evidence that most scholars can really agree on. I mean, we may not agree on some details, but a lot of the arguments that I made are fairly mainstream today. I don't think that the Jesus Seminar and some of those groups are really representing the mainstream.
Yeah, they get a lot more publicity, but yeah, they're on the radical fringe for the most part, aren't they?
Yeah.
When I looked at your book, when you sent me the review copy, and saw the endorsements that had been given by prominent scholars like James Charlesworth of Princeton and Gert Tyson, who had written one of the best books out there on the historical Jesus, and the things that these guys had to say about mm-hmm. your book was just phenomenal. I mean, you had to blush when you read those. They were just, I forgot exactly what they were, but I remember reading these and thought, wow, this is going to be a great book.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was
grateful for those
endorsements. I hope that this becomes a staple in universities all over the English-speaking world. I can't wait to break the pages of these books and of your book here, The Historical Jesus of the Gospels. There's so much I can learn from you, Craig, and really appreciate the time that you've taken this afternoon to spend with us.
Thanks so much. It's my privilege.